This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren, and it's great to have you with us. Welcome to all new and regular listeners. We are coming to you from Gothenburg in Sweden. You can follow us worldwide through our website, redicecreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com. We do radio, webcasts, films, and other video material, interviews with researchers on a wide variety of subjects that we consider to be important, interesting, and intriguing. Today we are going to talk about the Web of Debt with author Ellen Brown, who has written extensively on the current financial situation. She developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. In The Web of Debt, her latest book, she turns those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the Money Trust. She shows how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves, and how we the people can get it back. Ellen developed an interest in the developing world and its problems while living abroad for 11 years in Kenya, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. She has two websites out there that you can take a look at, webofdebt.com and ellenbrown.com. Her book is also available at amazon.com. And we're not going to spend too much time breaking down the whole story of the Federal Reserve here today, but we're going to turn our eyes towards what's going on right now in regards to the financial situation. So with that, welcome, Ellen. Thank you so much for coming on Red Ice Radio.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be on.
Excellent having you here. And obviously, there's so many things I want to ask you about in regards to the current situation, what is happening basically from your perspective. But maybe for listeners who might be new to the subject or might be new to your research, maybe you just can tell us a little bit about your work, Web of Debt, the book, and kind of a little bit of how you got involved in this area as well.
Okay. It's my 11th book, and my first 10 books were on health and the politics of health. I'm an attorney, and I represented some alternative cancer therapists, which got me into this whole area of suppression of alternative treatments and the whole pharmaceutical cartel. And then I learned that the pharmaceutical cartel, the money cartel, and the oil cartel are basically the same thing, and that where they get their power is that they have the power to create money. In fact, all of our money today, except for coins, certainly in the U.S., is created privately by banks. And so then I realized that in order to solve any of these problems, you have to solve the money problem. That's the fulcrum, the turning point. That's what has to be fixed.
Yes. And maybe you can just paint the picture for people who yet are not familiar with this topic of the Federal Reserve in regards to the United States and so forth, and what you found basically in regards to researching the Federal Reserve. There's so many misconceptions about basically who they are and what they do.
Mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve is privately owned by a consortium of banks. It consists of 12 branches, and each Federal Reserve branch is owned by the banks in that area. For example, the New York Federal Reserve, which is the biggest and the one that pretty much dominates, is owned by about 500 banks. And the biggest ones are J.P. Morgan and Citibank, although these days it seems that Goldman Sachs pretty much calls the shots. But anyway, they own the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve Act was set up in 1913 to backstop bank runs. So it's actually designed to serve the banks. It's not designed to serve the American people. And even if you assumed a very benevolent Federal Reserve chairman who wanted to help, he's actually limited by the terms of the Federal Reserve Act to doing things that help the banks. So that's one reason that right now, instead of just directly funding the government, which is what the Federal Reserve a country's central bank should do, I think, they're doing this very roundabout thing of trying to bail out the banks, which means just all our taxpayer money's going down this bottomless pit,
yes,
this black hole of trying to clean up the books of bankrupt derivatives banks that have huge, huge liabilities. So it came into existence. We have two competing monetary systems. So been around for 300 years or thousands of years, depending on how you want to look at it. But for the last 300 years, paper money, when paper money became popular, there was the privately issued paper money, which were called banknotes, and they were supposedly backed by gold. They were receipts for a sum of gold deposited with the bank. But the bank, this goes back to the goldsmiths of the 17th century, they quickly discovered that they could lend 10 times as many paper notes as they had gold. So that was the beginning of the fractional reserve system, where money is actually 9 out of 10 notes, obviously, were counterfeit or weren't backed by anything. So that was the beginning of the system that we have today. Of course, there's no gold now. It's all just paper money backed by, well, in the U.S., it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. So it's just credit backed by credit, or backed by U.S. bonds, which are more debt. And then the other system, the one that I think we should go back to, and the one that we fought the American Revolution for, according to Benjamin Franklin, is publicly issued money. For 100 years before the American Revolution, the colonies actually issued their own money publicly and funded their governments. And this worked really well. Well, it worked better in some places than others. But in general, the colonies were flourishing at a time when England was suffering the ravages of the Industrial Revolution. And this is said to be because in England they were heavily in debt, whereas in debt to the bankers, because all their money originated as debt. Whereas in the colonies, the governments could issue the money they needed for development. The ideal system was in Pennsylvania, where they actually owned a bank. So instead of just printing and spending, they printed money and lent it to the farmers, and then the money would come back to the bank, and they could lend it all over again. But the advantage over a private bank was that, first of all, they really had the money because it was, in fact, the credit of the government, and the interest came back to the Commonwealth, came back to the people, and could be lent again. So you didn't have this parasitic bleeding of profits off to a group that pretended to have money they didn't really have.
Yeah. And how do you think we ended up in this situation, or specifically now the U.S. then that we're talking about? But at this point in time, this seems to be the case all over the world, and we'll get into that a little bit later on here. But how could it be that the system that you're describing here, lastly, how was that moved away, so to speak? How did they manage to turn it over to a system which isn't backed by any real money or gold, so to speak?
In the American Revolution, the American colonists funded the revolution with these paper receipts, which was quite remarkable that they could actually win a war against a major world power without any what was considered money at the time, without gold. But the British had ships in the harbor outside New York that were madly printing these continentals. So they, as a matter of war policy, hyperinflated the currency. And it also hyperinflated for other reasons. It was it had to compete with other currencies. It was the paper money of an army that might not win, so people were reluctant to take it. And the speculators went around and bought it all up for pennies on the dollar toward the end of the war. So everybody got totally disillusioned with paper money. So they left it out of the Constitution. The very thing that they fought the war for, they left out. You know, that King George had forbidden the colonies from new issues of paper money. But that meant, because they didn't have gold, they had to pay their taxes in a currency they didn't have. And so the farmers were losing their farms to pay a foreign power that they didn't have a vote on. Those were all the constitutional or the revolutionary issues, taxation without representation, et cetera. But the problem was that they weren't allowed to use their own money. So they went back to using this paper money, and that was an act of rebellion. But then by the time they got through the revolution, they were so disillusioned, they thought it was the fault of paper money, where in fact it was the fault of a paper money that was easily counterfeited. And we know that now you can have a paper money that's perfectly
a replica or copy.
Yeah, it's trustworthy or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were actually deluded into giving up the thing they fought for. But then Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary, was faced with all these war debts. And there were soldiers outside, right outside the Constitutional Convention, demanding, they were rioting and demanding their pay, and there was nothing to pay them with. So he resorted to the ruse of the Bank of England, which was the privately issued money, where they set up a central bank, the first U.S. bank, which was 80% privately owned, and in the end it was 100% privately owned. So all the money of the government, all the gold the government has, was put into this bank, and that served as the reserves for many times that sum in loans. So then the bank could lend back to the government 10 times what it really had. So that worked, and they paid off all their creditors, and the economy got going. But the problem was that that was the beginning of this debt-based system, and we've never gotten out of it since.
Do you think it was a conspiracy by the British in an attempt to actually bankrupt the United States in this way?
Yes. Well, I think it was the British bankers who, they had lost their colonies, and so they lost them physically, so they went about recapturing them economically. I mean, you don't have to call it a conspiracy, but it's just they had lost this resource, and so they went about getting it in another way. I mean, it's the same thing that's happened ever since where, I mean, we've done it certainly in the last, ever since the dollar went off the gold standard and oil was quadrupled in the, you know, in the 70s. And there was this effort to put all these third world countries into debt to us so that they would be forced to sell us their resources at, you know, cheaply and their labor and so forth.
Yes.
So you don't necessarily have to call it a conspiracy. It's sort of just economics. It's just like, we need those things, and how can we get them if we don't own them as colonies? Well, we'll get them through debt.
Is there anything you can talk about in regards to the Bretton Woods Agreement? I haven't studied that too much, but it came up recently, actually, when I stumbled over what is known as the Tobin Tax, which has actually come up in the news recently, and we might get into a little bit more on that later on. But Bretton Woods Agreement, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that was in 1944, and it was an agreement to that. In 1933, Roosevelt took the dollar off the gold standard domestically, but the dollar was still on the gold standard internationally. And they needed, this is after World War II, or at the end of World War II, they needed a currency that countries could trade in, you know, that they could rely on to for their trade. And so gold was still considered the ideal, but there wasn't that much gold out there. So it was gold backed by the dollar. So the deal was that the dollar would be worth $35. I mean, sorry, an ounce of gold would be worth 35 U.S. dollars, and that the government would stand behind that. So everybody did their international trade in dollars. It was as if we were on a gold standard, but gold was rarely used. It was still the dollars. But then in 1971, Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard because we had gone into debt because of the Vietnam War, and then the French under de Gaulle had cashed in all their dollars for gold. They didn't trust that the U.S. had the gold to back the dollars. So they cashed in all their dollars for gold, which was a big chunk out of our gold stash. And then the British were tried to do the same thing. And so Nixon said, sorry, you know, that's gonna break the bank. And so he closed the gold window. And from then on, it was the dollar itself that became the international reserve currency.
And have the world moved away from the dollar as the world's reserve currency? I've heard this a lot back and forth. Some are suggesting that the euro might be the next one of these. Has this been implemented yet? I haven't heard anything more about this, actually.
Yes, sir. I've read quite a bit about it. There's many countries. The Chinese, of course, are agitating for the more SDRs. That's the special drawing rights of the IMF, which I guess the IMF got $1 trillion recently. So, I mean, they're padding up their reserves. And then here in the the South and Central American countries are getting together to do their own currency to try to break away from the dollar. And then the Asian countries are talking about coming up with their own reserves, which, if you ask me, is not a bad thing. Everybody thinks it would be a disaster for the dollar if they may move away from the dollar as a reserve currency. Well, it might not be great for our banks, but I think for our people, it's actually probably a good thing.
How would it be different? How would it change things for you guys?
Well, the concern is that there'll be suddenly not this demand for dollars. But, you know, there aren't enough dollars out there. We're actually in a huge depression. I mean, a huge contraction of the currency. That what you have to understand, and this is what my whole book is about, is that all of our money is debt. There's nothing out there except debt.
Yeah.
If there were no banks, we wouldn't have any money. All money is created by banks when they make loans. So after the when the housing market collapsed, when the shadow lenders went away, as they're called, the people, the funds basically that were buying all those collateralized debt obligations, and they were buying securitized mortgages from the banks, allowing them to issue yet more loans and yet more loans. The shadow lenders went away, and basically they took with them $10 trillion. So there's a $10 trillion hole in the old money supply. So the government, the U.S. government, they're doing here is they're madly going into debt because somebody has to go into debt in order to create the money supply under our existing system. Mm. And then the Federal Reserve was monetizing some of that. Last spring, they said they were going to buy $300 billion worth of long-term government debt. But then everybody got all upset. The Chinese are upset that we're hyperinflating the dollar and going to devalue it. But we're not. That's the point. We're just bringing it back up, or they are just trying to bring it back up to where it once was, trying to fill that hole where there's just no money in that hole. And meanwhile, abroad, there's this big demand for dollars because it is the reserve currency. Well, if it weren't the reserve currency, there'd be less pressure on the dollar, and so we could get some of our own dollars back. I mean, here we are begging for customers, so why don't we let them trade in something else and bring our own dollars back to our own shores where they could... We're not going to say your dollar's not worth anything. Come and shop in our country. Use your dollars to spend on our products instead of us spending on yours all the time.
How about the whole talk about the Amero and so forth? If U.S., Canada, Mexico moves over to a single currency, would that change things? How do you think that would transform the U.S. money system?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen. I just think there's too much sentiment against it, and I think they missed their chance. They probably were actually considering it, but I think what's more likely is there'll be this special drawing rights will be the foot in the door for a global currency. And, you know, what really worries me is that Financial Stability Board that the G20 countries just agreed to. So this is a global regulator based in the Bank for International Settlements, which has a very shady history. And they can they'll be a global regulator for anything financial. I mean, it's so broad what they've been given control over, and there's no democratic system. I mean, it doesn't say that we get X number of votes and there's a veto power and, you know, nothing like the way you set up a Congress, or it's just committees. It's all done by committees, which sound to me a lot like the Soviet committees that did things. I don't know.
Well, exactly. And who is behind, by the way, the Bank of International Settlements? Is it bankers on the boards there as well to regulate the money system? Or what do they do today? Are they involved in anything of this?
That's what the Financial Stability Board is. It's supposed to be regulating things financial. It goes back to an earlier board, which was just advisory when it was the G7, and now it's expanded to the G20. In other words, they have control over more countries, and this one is mandatory. I mean, everybody's signed on to having this actual regulator that they'll all comply with these rules. And it hasn't been set out what the rules are, or, you know, what the guidelines are, or what the limits are on this body. It's only just started, so probably nothing. It'll all be gradual. But that's the way they do things, where they can point back to 10 years ago. Well, you signed up for this, and we've all agreed to do it. I know, for instance, that two examples I can think of, and one is Sweden. So I'd be interested in your your interpretation on this, but I was told by a New Zealander that in New Zealand they owned their own central bank like in the 30s and 40s, and they would make loans to the government with their own through their own central bank. So basically they were funding their own development, and this worked really well. It helped them escape the depression. And then at some point the United Kingdom said that if they didn't get in line with the rest of the Commonwealth and privatize their central bank, that they would be cut off from trading with the Commonwealth. And therefore they went along with the deal, and now they no longer borrow from a public central bank. They borrow privately. And the Canadians have done the same thing. You know, they used to borrow from their own central bank, and now they borrow privately. And I was told that Sweden, which had the first ever central bank,
yes,
I was told this by a Swedish man, and you know, it was in a Google group, that Sweden had the first ever central bank. It was publicly owned. It lent money to the government. In other words, that's the way it should be. I think that was the original setup of the Pennsylvania colony that worked so well for the U.S. But then when Sweden joined the EU, they were told they could no longer borrow from their own central bank. That's what I was told. Do you know anything about that?
I think that's correct, actually, because I know that before we did join the European Union, we had a big financial, basically, crash in Sweden around the 90s. Our economy was kind of open up to the world a little bit before that. It was actually after our Prime Minister Olof Palme was shot, and after that point, our financial market kind of opened up to other international players, so to speak. George Soros, among others, was one who actually bought up a whole lot of Swedish currency and almost crashed our entire economy because of it. And then in November 92, the Swedish crown almost collapsed, and they changed the policy, the regime afterwards at that point. And actually, I'm not too sure because I haven't researched this yet myself too much. I'm not sure how much it changed after that point in time. So this would actually be something very interesting to check up on and see if that's true or not today. But I would reckon that this has changed now after we gone into the EU, because they, of course, just even started up a European Central Bank, which all the nations on the EU is going to be under, so to speak. So that much I know.
Mm-hmm.
Any comments?
That's interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's interesting about George Soros crashing the currency, but because I think that's what they do in general. That's the plan. I know that he and his hedge fund crashed or helped to crash the Southeast Asian countries' currencies in 1998, but he was backed by some big banks. So you could certainly imagine a plan to attempt to bring down these currencies in order to get them in line, you know, to get certain concessions out of them.
Exactly, line them up and make them, because it seems also that this type of monetary culture, so to speak, that we have kind of demands new victims, so to speak, on a regular basis, meaning that they need injections of a new economy or even a new monetary system of a whole country. As far as I heard, even Iraq was one of these countries who, after they got invaded, immediately set up a central bank, and the currency was, or the money in that country was...
Private central.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can you confirm that? Have you heard that too?
Yes, well, I've read that too. And that's the nature. Again, that's the whole subject of my book, Web of Debt. That's the nature of the current system, is that it's parasitic. It has to continually feed on new debt. That's why there's always this emphasis on growth, growth, growth. In other words, you have to keep expanding your economy. The reason is that banks create the principal, but they don't create the interest. So, for instance, if it's a 30-year loan, a mortgage, here in the U.S., you wind up paying more in interest than you paid in principal. So where did that interest come from? Somebody somewhere has to have taken out another loan to create the interest, because banks are the only way you can get money in the system, except for coins, which are almost nothing. You know, it's just a token. It's just enough to make people think that the government has some role here.
So it's just the bottom line here is that it's an awful system, and it will not survive in the long term, right? I mean, something's got to give here, and the question is where do we go in this situation? I mean, right now there are kind of they're trying to reform the financial system right now. They're trying to prevent bankers from getting big bonuses. This has been a suggestion now coming in from the EU. And now I think it is next week, this G20 meeting is going to take place in Pittsburgh. And what's your take on that? Are you keeping your eye on that? What do you think will be the outcome of this, so to speak?
I haven't looked at that meeting particularly, but my concern is that in law, they say good cases make bad law. So they focus on something that everybody agrees is outrageous, these high bonuses. That was the way they got this Financial Stability Board agreed to, is they said, well, we need global regulation. You know, we need to set some rules globally so everybody has to follow along. And there's certainly merit to that. So then they come out with the outrageous case that, look at these huge bonuses that these banks are getting in the U.S. Certainly, they're getting them from the taxpayers because they just got these huge bailout, this huge amount of bailout money.
Yes.
So that's an outrage, and we should control that. We should regulate that. So then everybody signs up to the Financial Stability Board. Good idea. We need regulation. But they're not looking at the potential of this regulatory body to do very onerous, oppressive things. I agree. The system must collapse as it currently exists. So there's this frantic race between, I mean, I don't know that we even know we're racing. That's why I'm so frantically writing and talking, because to make people aware of what they're taking away. Everybody knows that something bad is going on and that we're losing our money and we're in a depression and that the banks are probably the culprits. But
yeah.
But the thing that people, that we've been told is a bad thing, is actually a good thing. Everything's upside down, and people don't realize that. That everybody blames the government for, you know, screwing up the money system, but the government didn't do the money system. In the U.S., the government is a victim like everybody else. I mean, you could say the government now is a crook because it's been essentially taken over by the mafia, but it's not the fault of a representative government. Nobody even trusts, you know, the whole idea of democracy anymore because look what our government has done. But that's the thing. It's not democratic. It's not our government. The banks took over. So what we think we don't want, which is the government to print more money, is actually what we do want. We want our money to come from the government, which is us, voted on, you know, by
yes.
the Senate and,
yes.
and so forth, rather than coming through these private banks that have total control over who they give it to, that they can invest it in, you know, very speculative, destructive things that aren't producing anything, derivatives and so forth.
Because I'm also thinking about what you mentioned here in regards to the government and so forth, and it seems to me that the bankers obviously have placed their men now in government. It's, you know, the swing door politics thing. They might be on the board of a big bank one day, then they're in politics the next to make decisions that benefits the private banks, and back and forth they go all the time. One of these guys, I think recently, Timothy Geithner, who's the United States Secretary of Treasury, said to the Wall Street Journal, I think in a video interview there, that he absolutely not would like to see some kind of audit of the Fed or something like that. He, of course, which they pointed it out even in that interview, seems to have connections to Goldman Sachs, which you mentioned before as being kind of one of the main guys behind the whole financial debacle, pretty much, that we're in right now. Do you think that people like this are... that is the kind of people who are detrimental to the system because they don't allow people to openly look at their own system, so to speak. That there are they keep their gateway. What do you say? They protect people from actually realizing what's going on. Or what's your take on Timothy Geithner and what he's doing right now?
I totally agree with you, and go back to Henry Paulson, who was an even more powerful Goldman Sachs man, and it was under Henry Paulson that we had the whole bailout system was set up. Well, when he was CEO of Goldman Sachs, that's when they developed all these financial products that were sold to Europeans and Asians and so forth that turned out to be fraudulent. So in theory, there's a huge, huge potential liability against those banks for setting up these financial products that weren't AAA like they were touted to be. So you can almost envision that them getting together behind closed doors and saying, you know, we've got to get into government and change the laws here to save our own skins here, or we're going to be liable for some very massive lawsuits.
Yeah.
So that's what they did. They made Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac basically government agencies. Those are the two agencies in charge of the mortgages. And, you know, so it's through the mortgages were collateralized debt obligations were mortgage-backed securities wrapped in a derivative. I don't know if I need to go into all that. But anyway, they basically nationalized Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And the Federal Reserve gave $85 billion to AIG, which is an insurance company. I mean, you have to wonder under what provision is an insurance company covered?
Yes.
And you know, the biggest recipient of the AIG bailout was Goldman Sachs.
Really? No.
They got $13 billion out of the deal. And this was for credit default swaps, which are like sheer and utter gambling. Why is it that the taxpayers are on the hook for Goldman Sachs' bad gambling debt?
Yeah.
But that's the way it is, because the people in charge are from Goldman Sachs. And of course, Robert Rubin was the original. Robert Rubin in 1994 moved in to become Treasury Secretary. He moved right from Goldman Sachs to become Treasury Secretary at a time when Goldman Sachs was heavily invested in these Mexican bonds that were going sour. So he engineered the whole, it was called a bailout of Mexico, but it wasn't. It was a bailout of the banks that had lent money to Mexico.
So it's a confusion of terms. And by the way, Robert Rubin is chairman on the Council on Foreign Relations as well. Might be interesting. So some people are looking into that group. But basically, what the heck is happening here? I mean, we had recently now then about some media and some sources say almost 2 million people marching on Washington, D.C. Some of that, okay, was for allegedly Obama's health reforms and all this, but many people were there because of the financial situation and the bailouts as well. What's your take on that? What needs to happen here for this to change? And if people demand a change in the system, do you think that that will actually play into the hands, so to speak, of the bankers? Will it ultimately benefit them in some way if we let them also reform the system that we're currently in? What do you think?
That's why I think it's very important for everybody to understand what's really happening and what we really want here. Because otherwise, we will, like you say, we'll think we're doing reforms, and the reforms will be in the hands of the people that, in other words, the fox will be watching the hen house, be in charge of the hen house.
Yeah.
I think the whole system could be saved. I mean, basically, what you need to do is push the reset button. The whole accounting system is wrong, and if you change the whole system, then we could have abundance everywhere. In other words, if you realize that money is only, it's only a legal agreement, it's only, that barter is obviously just a legal agreement. I mean, there are actually things where you can trade online, where you're basically just trading the thing. But loans are the difficult thing, is where money comes into existence as credit. Now, if you realize that credit is only a legal agreement between parties, then the proper party to oversee this agreement would be the government, just as the judiciary oversees other forms of contractual agreements. So what you have is the buyer wants his, or the seller wants his money now. The buyer doesn't have it. So the buyer says, trust me to pay you over time, and I'll pay you a little extra in the form of interest. But the seller doesn't know the buyer, so he doesn't trust them. But they do trust this third party known as a bank that's been around in town for a long time. So they go to the bank, and the bank says, all right, I'll pretend to have the money, and I'll pay the seller. And then the buyer will pay me over time, and he'll pay extra for me taking the risk that he doesn't pay. But the problem is that it was all fraudulent. There's an inherent fraud here that the bank's pretending to have money it doesn't have.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't satisfy the capital requirements, reserve requirements, et cetera, it really is on the hook, and it can go down. And banks are going down right and left now because of those restrictions. So if you acknowledge that that's the role of the bank, that let's have a government bank, and the two parties go to the government bank, and the government checks out the bona fides, the solvency and the ability to pay, et cetera, of the borrower, and says, okay, we're going to keep track of this borrower, and we know when he skips town, we can follow him. We've got all the resources of the government, so that the government bank just oversees the deal, and pays the credit of the community to the seller, and then this credit is repaid by the buyer over time. So then all the profits go back to the center. You have a mathematically sound system. You're not, bleeding off interest somewhere else, profits somewhere else that are taken out of the system.
So do you think that interest is one of the biggest problems in the system as well, so to speak? But currently, that's the only way for the banking system at the moment to inject itself with more money, so to speak, to have this the interest game going on here at the same time, or is there anything else that is more detrimental, I guess, to the current financial system?
Well, interest is the problem. I mean, interest is what turns it into a pyramid scheme or a Ponzi scheme. The fact that there's never enough money to pay off the debts, because you're always owing more back than you took out, and the money is actually created in the process of taking it out. But I don't think interest is necessarily a bad thing. Although simple interest would certainly make more sense than compound interest.
What's the difference there for people who don't know?
Compound interest is where interest is added to interest. So if you borrow at 10% interest, so the first year you borrow $1,000, and at the end of the year you owe $1,100, and then at the end of the next year you owe 10% of $1,100 plus the $1,100. Whereas simple interest would be, so it keeps adding on. And if you look at a graph of compound interest, it in maybe 20 years, it depends on the interest rate, it starts going exponential. You know, it starts shooting skyward. So very quickly, you owe far more money than you can ever pay. That's why the third world countries are in this horrible debt trap, because interest rates went to 20% around 1980. When all those third world countries got locked into debt after the oil was quadrupled on purpose in order to put them into debt.
Do you see that that's a connection between the bankers then, as you alluded to this in the beginning of the program, of course, that there's a connection here between the oil market and the bankers, and they work, they have a cartel pretty much here, and together they can regulate their own profits, so to speak. Is that what you think is going on here?
Well, when the dollar went off the gold standard in 1971, apparently there's good evidence that Henry Kissinger went over to the OPEC countries and said, I'm going to make you very rich, or words to the effect, I'm going to make you very rich. We're going to quadruple the price of oil. But in return, you are going to put all that oil money, you're going to sell your oil only in dollars, and you're going to put your dollars in our U.S. banks. So that was the deal. And then also Kissinger said he would afford them protection, and it was a type of arrangement where they couldn't afford to say no, because without the protection of the U.S. military, they were in trouble from their own people, et cetera. So essentially the dollar became backed by oil.
Yeah.
In other words, because oil had to be bought in dollars, That gave the dollar strength. But then after Saddam Hussein was one of the first to not sell his oil in dollars, to break with that system and turn to the euro. Mm-hmm. And at first everybody thought he was mad that he was going to get cut off. But in fact what happened was the euro went up, and he made out quite well, which would have set a very bad precedent. So there are people who think that that's what the Iraq War was all about, was to halt this precedent.
There you go. And do you think it's true that the U.S. holds the major power here? I mean, again, there's a lot of people who are suggesting that the U.S. is only, how should I put it, a tool in this situation, and that the people involved, the bankers, so to speak, are more, they're more internationally inclined. They don't have a country's interest first at hand, so to speak. They only have their own interest first, that goes first. Would you agree with that?
I would. And, you know, there are quotes like that that go back for hundreds of years. Napoleon said that, that the international bankers were, they were not to be trusted because they had no national allegiance, and they were just interested in money, making money.
So there's a few different things I want to ask you a little bit about here as well in regards to what's going on right now. You mentioned before that some banks seem to go under AIG, this insurance company, pretty much, and then you had the Lehman Brothers as well going under over almost a year ago now, I think. And do you think there is a purging or almost like a pruning going on in a way? Do you think that they want less but bigger banks to be in charge of the new global financial system, which seems to kind of rise out of the ashes of the current situation? What's your take on that?
Two things. I think in the U.S., they're trying to, I mean, assuming you, it's quite plausible. I don't like to call myself a conspiracy theorist, but it's quite plausible that there is an effort here to reduce the U.S. to a third world country.
Yes.
I mean, the idea is to level everybody, to bring everybody to the same status. So then when they come out with their global, when all our currencies have collapsed and we're all in desperate straits, then they come out with their global currency and say, here, we're going to save you with our global currency. Borrow some of this.
Yeah.
And then we'll all be in the same boat, you know, that the third world countries are in right now, where they all have to borrow from the IMF, you know, currency not their own that they can't issue. So there's that. Now I forgot what. Oh, but I also think that the big banks have to. It's like you said, it's a parasite. It has to eat smaller banks periodically. They have to feed on smaller banks to stay alive. I mean, J.P. Morgan's the big example. They have $180 trillion in derivatives, or they did like a year ago, an incredible sum. So how can they possibly keep feeding that derivatives book? They've got to take over these. They ate Bear Stearns. You know, they absorbed Bear Stearns for pennies on the dollar. They got the stock for pennies on the dollar.
Mm.
And they've gotten money in a number of different places, you know, from these various bailouts.
Sheesh, it's just incredible. And, I mean, again, you mentioned IMF, for instance, then, the International Monetary Fund. And basically, we're in debt, right? But who are lending money to us, so to speak? Who are we owing money here on the international scene? It just seems absurd when you look at it from the point of view that we're on a planet here spinning out in space and everyone owes each other money, or what's going on here?
Exactly. We don't owe it to other countries. The countries I'm trying to think of a better word than screwed.
The countries have been taken advantage.
They've been taken advantage of, you know, that. Well, in fact, there was this famous line. Well, Carol Quigley wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope. He
yes.
was an insider who said he was actually approved of this whole international monetary scheme. He approved of their methods and their goals. The one thing he disagreed with was that they wanted to keep it all private, and he thought they should go public. And in fact, he was the one that revealed what the Bank for International Settlements was all about. But he said that the goal was to make it look like governments were issuing the money, but actually it would be these private international banks issuing the money and lending it to the government. So the banks would have control privately.
Yeah.
And that's certainly what they've done. Everybody thinks that their governments issue their money. I certainly actually thought so until I got into researching this book. And I mean, I'm a fairly mature and sophisticated person. But nobody tells you. Nobody teaches you that in school.
That's right.
That all your money comes from banks.
Just incredible. And how is it in regards to the IRS, for instance, in the States? Is that a private institution as well? Or is that government regulated and owned? And do the people own IRS, so to speak?
The IRS is a government agency, but there are many questions about whether it's legal. You know, whether the arrangement under which it takes money is legal. Many people have resisted paying. I hesitate to do that because you could definitely go to jail over that. Many people have gone to jail over it. So, but yeah, the IRS was set up in 1913 along with the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve Act and the 16th Amendment, which allowed the federal government to issue an income tax or collect an income tax, went hand in hand. And the whole goal of the 16th Amendment was to provide a source of income for the interest that the Federal Reserve knew that they were going to be getting, or the bankers, you know, hiding behind the Federal Reserve with this front of a Federal Reserve, knew that they were going to be getting from the government now that the government was going to have to borrow from them. Originally, under the Federal Reserve Act, interest was paid to the Federal Reserve. But in the 60s, Wright Patman came along and looked. He was head of the House Banking and Currency Committee, and he looked very closely at what was going on and saw that there was something very fishy here, that the Federal Reserve was printing dollars just for the cost of the paper and was lending them to the U.S. government and charging us interest on it. So he wanted to nationalize the Federal Reserve, and that didn't happen. But what the Federal Reserve did do was they said, okay, we'll rebate the interest after deducting our costs. So now we almost have a capital central bank. I mean, that ideally, the government should, I'm wandering off from your question, but anyway, ideally the government should go to the central bank and say, here's our debt, monetize it.
Yeah.
That's what should happen, because governments should be creating their own money, and they could do it as a loan through their own central bank, just as a matter of accounting. And that's what Canada did for, and I think Sweden also did for many years until this whole, well, until the late 70s, early 80s, when they had that whole monetarist movement under Milton Friedman.
Okay, yeah, who totally, well, revamped the financial system as far as I've understood it. And maybe, Ellen, we can go into a little bit more on that in our next hour here for members. I have so many more questions that I want to ask you in regards to what currently is going on. But please, to round things up here for the first hour, tell us your website's addresses again, and give us the title to your book so people who want to find out more about the Federal Reserve System and understand the current situation, how they can get more information, basically, and inform themselves in these times, so to speak. So go ahead and mention that for us.
Okay, my website is webofdebt.com, and that's also the name of my book, Web of Debt, which you could also get on Amazon. And on my website, I have many, many articles. I try to write an article every week or two on the current situation. So, and I only write on things that I think are shocking and, you know, cutting edge, things that other people haven't noticed. And then I have an active blog that's linked. There's a blog link at the top of Web of Debt. So if you want to ask questions, et cetera, you can go to the blog. And then my other website is ellenbrown.com, which has all my other books on it.
Webofdebt.com, ellenbrown.com. Thank you very much. Stay with us. We have a really important hour two coming up with Ellen Brown for Red Ice members, and we discuss many things, solutions obviously being one of them. But some of the highlights that we talk about is the unemployment issue, resources, the whole environmental issue that is strangling a lot of industries. And we talk about how we organically can move over to new industries and new technologies. For example, more green propulsion systems instead of how we're seeing things playing out right now, where a lot of people end up without a job. We talk about the New World Order and their plans. And the big perpetrator in this picture, the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements. And Switzerland comes up yet again with their Basel Accord, Basel 1, 2, and 3. They decide, they make the rules, we suffer. And why do we follow along with this? We talk about subprime lending, who should regulate the financial system. We talk about taxation of gambling and the implementation of the Tobin tax. A global tax is an old suggestion brought up now yet again by French Prime Minister Nicolas Sarkozy as a way to basically fund the bankers' gambling. We talk about the housing market, how to organize, and what can be done, and so much more. So join us for a very interesting hour two with Ellen Brown in the member section. All information on how you can sign up and get instant access to to this program and so many more is available on our website, redeyescreations.com. It's quick, easy, and safe. You can enjoy, of course, all of our entire radio programs, our archives with films, webcasts, and all the rest that we have up there for you. We'll be back with more radio soon. Nick Rosen will join us to discuss basically how to get out of the, or stay out of the Big Brother grid. We'll talk with Kevin P. Miller on his film Generation RX. David Icke will join us on the swine flu issue and vaccination. Cliff High from halfpasthuman.com, part two with Andrew Bashago, to name just a few. But we'll be back after some music with hour two of Ellen Brown.
Hollywood, I've been to Redwood, I crossed the ocean.